Healy was Mr. Happy today, one joke after another. But his tension was evident in the set of his shoulders and the glances he kept sending Danny's way. Danny was sitting at his desk, head bent over his work, ignoring the crack and the messing around him. He hadn't been around at all for the last 2 days. Cormac had looked for him a couple of times, and when he hadn't found him, had assumed that he'd gone to Dublin after all, to track down Laura's elusive friend. The fact that he was back at his desk suggested that whatever he'd found in Dublin was good news. Cormac would drag him out for pints that evening, without Fisher, and check that all was okay. Maybe push a bit more about Healy. In the meantime, he had work to do. The meeting with Catherine Shelley hadn't brought much new information, once he'd had a chance to sit down and analyze it, but in a backward sort of way, that was helpful. She had given him a different take on Mrs. Keene, now the helpful neighbor, according to Catherine Shelley. Why had she wanted the children to stay with a mother who abused them? If she was that close, that present, she must have known what was going on. Tom Collins had been very sure that Keane was the one supplying the alcohol. It should have been counterintuitive, that whole story, that a religious woman would have interfered with social workers trying to care for those children, that she would have plied an alcoholic with booze. Somehow it wasn't. Somehow it was utterly predictable. How much of his views about Catholic Ireland had been formed by the outpouring of stories of abuse over the past 10 years, from the Magdalen Laundries to Brendan Smith? Had he felt the same way, suspicious of all things religious, back in the '90s? He honestly couldn't remember. He was still mulling over this when his phone buzzed, and a voice he didn't recognize told him that he was to report to Chief Inspector Murphy's office as soon as possible. Cormac gathered the file in his notebook and left the room, climbing the stairs to Murphy's office. Murphy's aide, a female officer, waved him directly in. Murphy listened politely enough while Cormac walked him through his work so far. It was premature for a briefing. He'd only had the case a few days. A review meeting this early smacked of micromanagement. What happened to preliminary report by Friday? Murphy leaned back in his chair, allowing it to swivel slightly from side to side as he listened to Cormac. He had a pen in one hand, which he wiggled between two fingers, occasionally bringing it down on the desk and letting it play against the surface in a drumming motion that punctuated Cormac's report. It was distracting, as was the tension on Murphy's face. He waited until Cormac had gone through it all, right up to the social worker interview, Cormac's planned next steps, and his view that the investigation was, so far, not showing any signs that it would yield a suspect, let alone an arrest. When he finished speaking, Murphy paused for effect, then sighed.
"That's it?"
"Yes, sir," said Cormac. "There's not much there. I suppose after 20 years it's inevitable to some degree." But Murphy was shaking his head.
"And Detective Hackett hasn't spoken to you about the evidence her team's been able to uncover?"
Cormac had said nothing. "Melanie Hackett? Danny's boss?" Danny reported to her when he wasn't seconded to the drugs unit. She was young, she was ambitious, and as far as he knew, she had nothing whatsoever to do with his case.
"I'll admit to being disappointed, Detective. I'd heard good things about you, but perhaps I expected too much."
Before Cormac had a chance to respond, Murphy pressed the intercom button.
"Send them in," was all he said.
Cormac turned as the door opened and watched as Danny and Melanie Hackett walked into the room. Murphy gestured for them to take the two remaining chairs, which necessitated an awkward shuffle over from Cormac to allow Mel access to the chair in the middle. Mel gave him a nod, then ignored him, but Danny, who appeared for once both rested and reasonably well-dressed, he was wearing slacks and a dark blue shirt with a navy Ralph Lauren pony on the left breast, looked at him and tried and failed to communicate a silent message. Cormac had no idea what was going on, but the signs weren't good. Murphy nodded to Mel Hackett.
"Mel, perhaps you should fill Detective Riley in on the assistance you can offer him with his case."
When she spoke, Hackett addressed herself to Murphy.
"As you know, sir, McIntyre has been seconded to Operation Sparrow."
She turned her attention to Cormac and spoke briefly.
You may be aware that the task force is focused on possible drug running routes into Europe from landings on the west coast of Ireland. Early on in the operation, it focused on gathering information from our local lower-level informants in an attempt to confirm information provided by MAOC. MAOC was the Lisbon-based Maritime Analysis and Operations Centre, staffed with law enforcement personnel from European countries, including Ireland. Gorda McIntyre was aware of some of the details of D.S. Riley's case. He knew that D.S. Riley was searching for a source for heroin in Kilmore in 1993. McIntyre ran a search through Pulse and came up with a name. A young woman from Kilmore was taken into custody in 1994. She was found in the company of a drug dealer in Castle Bar who was thought to be underage, so someone took her in, took her details. That was the first time she was picked up, but it wasn't the last.
And this woman's in prison now?
Murphy asked,
looking for early release in exchange for information?
Yes, sir. Murphy nodded and gestured for Hackett to continue. I encourage anyone who reports to me to use their initiative, Hackett said, and that is exactly what Gorda McIntyre did. He ran her name through our database and found that she had provided information to Operation Sparrow in the past, though that information hadn't been useful. He decided that there was a chance she would have information that would be relevant to D.S. Riley's operation. As it was something of a long shot, he thought he would interview the informant himself before bringing any possible information to D.S. Riley. His hunch paid off far better than he expected.
I was going to Dublin anyway, Danny said hurriedly. Really, I didn't expect anything to come of it, or I would have brought it straight to D.S. Riley, but I...
Hackett gave him a look that said, shut the fuck up, as clearly as if she'd said the words out loud.
So you brought that information to me,
Murphy said to Hackett. His tone was on the dry side of neutral, and she flushed slightly.
You didn't think this information would be best provided directly to D.S. Riley?
D.S. Riley wasn't at his desk, sir, when the information came to me, and I thought it best that I provide it to you without delay. Cormac kept his expression bland, uninterested, but inside he was cursing himself. He'd underestimated the hostility towards him in the station, and he was about to pay for that mistake.
Well, he's here now, Murphy said.
Hackett hesitated, then turned to Cormac. The informant's name is Hannah Collins. She grew up in Kilmore. Her younger brother was, as I understand it, very close to your suspect.
You're talking about Thomas Collins, said Cormac, his voice flat.
Hannah Collins was arrested last year. She's an addict, her boyfriend's a dealer. The boyfriend beat up another addict who owed him money. Hannah was involved. She was convicted of conspiracy to commit GBH and sentenced to 5 years. She served just under a year. McIntyre, would you please report the substance of your interview with Hannah Collins? Danny cleared his throat.
He didn't look at Cormac. I was aware from conversations with D.S. Riley that he was investigating a suspicious death in Kilmore in the 90s. The victim died from a heroin overdose. As D.S. Hackett said, I found Hannah's name on Pulse, figured that if she was doing drugs in Kilmore in 94, there was a reasonable chance that she might know where D.S. Riley's suspect could have bought heroin in 1993. I saw she was in prison. I ran her name through the Operation Sparrow database and found she'd been an informant once before.
Danny shrugged.
He looked miserable. I thought it would be worth visiting her while I was there. See if she had any idea who would have been supplying heroin locally back in the day.
Danny shifted his weight awkwardly.
I would have spoken to D.S. Riley first, but as D.S. Hackett said, I thought it was a bit of a long shot.
A long shot worth taking, it seems,
Murphy said.
Yes, sir.
Shit. There was nothing Cormac could do but sit back and watch it coming. Danny continued.
Hannah's given a statement. She says that Maud Blake came to her directly to ask her to procure heroin for her. Hannah introduced Maud to her boyfriend at the time who sold heroin to Maud. 2 days later, Elaria Blake died of an overdose.
Cormac finally escaped the office 15 minutes later. It was agreed that Hannah Collins's statement would be passed to him by Danny and Mel. He was to get full copies of Hilaria Blake's medical records, assuming that they hadn't been destroyed. And then he was to bring Maud in for questioning. He didn't go far.
just walked to the end of the corridor and waited at the corner. As he'd suspected, Danny got the boot shortly afterwards. Murphy wanted to speak with Melanie Hackett alone. Cormac gave Danny a jerk of the head, then turned and walked down the stairs and out of the station, not looking to see if Danny would follow. He turned left at the steps and walked into the car park, waited. Why hadn't Danny come to him? Ambition?
Anna Collins, Cormac said when Danny reached him. Is this bullshit, Dan? Why is it this smells of bullshit to me? Christ, Cormac, I'm sorry.
I don't want to hear about sorry. You could have called me 40 times since yesterday and you chose not to.
It wasn't like that. I couldn't call you last night because my phone died. By the time I got out of Dokus, it was dead as a doornail, and I got back too late. I wasn't bothered about it because I figured I'd see you this morning and I'd tell you then.
Danny, you were sitting at your desk all morning. You could have given me a heads up at any time.
Danny grimaced. Hackett was waiting for me when I got in. I told Healy that I had to go to Dublin to work on something for her. Look, I've no holidays left. I had to take the time. Lorna's friend hadn't called me back all week, and no one who knows her knew anything about a music festival. They all thought Lorna was coming home for the weekend.
Christ. Cormac blew out a long breath.
Hackett was all over me. She was going to put me on report. I can't afford to have her pissed off at me too. You know I'm on the outs with the task force. If Hackett won't work with me, I'm fucked. And I just moved the family to Galway. So I told her about the Collins thing to get her off my back.
Did you find her?
Lorna's friend?
Yeah. Danny's face was grim. I found her and it was all bullshit. She never saw Lorna there. She just said she had, because when she saw on social media that Lorna's family were looking for her, she assumed Lorna was up to something she didn't want to share with us. She lied, stupid bitch, because she thought Lorna would appreciate a bit of cover. It was only when Lorna never called her back, never answered her messages, that she realized something more might be going on. And then she started to freak out, went to ground. Cormac said nothing. He was still angry with Danny for throwing him under the bus. But at the same time, what Danny was dealing with was far more serious than a career, what, blip? Danny should have told Hackett the truth about what was going on. Cormac felt an overwhelming urge to hit someone, and it wasn't just because of the politics.
Hannah Collins. She's motivated?
What?
Hackett said she'd tried to peddle information before, but it wasn't useful. Now she's selling out an old friend. What's her motivation?
Danny had the grace to look embarrassed.
She's had a baby while she's been inside. Baby's 10 months old.
Jesus, Dan.
I know, but Cormac, I'm telling you. She just came out with all this stuff. It was too detailed, too fast. It has to be true.
And you offered her the deal?
I didn't commit, but I hinted at it.
Dokus, the women's prison attached to Mountjoy, was overcrowded and underfunded. Drug abuse was rampant. Women who came to Dokus pregnant or with a young infant were allowed to keep their babies with them until they were 12 months old. Then the baby had to be taken from the prison into the care of a family member, or if that wasn't possible, to foster care. If Hannah Collins had a baby and wanted to keep it, she could not have better motivation to lie about what had happened 20 years before.
Danny, this information is shaky at best. I don't care how fast she came up with the story.
Hannah Collins had read Danny and played him. Cormac was sure of it.
Hackett going straight to Murphy with this was out of line. It was fucking unprofessional.
Danny glanced back towards the station.
She would never have come to you. I should have copped that from the beginning.
There was a sudden bustle at the station door, voices in conversation. It was a group of young uniforms, probably coming off shift. Cormac became aware of his stance and his expression, and he consciously relaxed his posture. If the uniforms were curious about the conversation, they didn't show it, studiously keeping their attention on each other as they walked to the other end of the car park.
Why?
Asked Cormac.
Why wouldn't Hackett come to me?
Danny shook his head slowly, looked at him watchfully.
There's a rumour going around, Danny said, about you and Maud Blake. Someone saw you leaving her hotel room on Tuesday morning, very early.
Cormac's mouth fell open. He stood there, gaping, for what felt like minutes. Then the fury barreled through him.
Are you fucking kidding me?
He hissed.
I got the case on Monday, went to the pub with you and Fisher in case you've forgotten, but somehow I ended up in bed with Maud Blake, someone I first met as a victim, as a child, my fucking suspect, a couple of hours later.
Danny shrugged, looked away. I went home early, he said, left you to it. Jesus Christ. Cormac had never wanted to hit someone as much as he wanted to hit Danny in that moment. He shoved his hands in his pockets.
I'm not saying anything happened, Danny said. Personally, I don't believe it, and I told him that. But people know about you and Emma. They're saying you have form.
Cormac felt the rage burn up through him, a flash of fury so intense that for a moment his vision darkened. He hid it all behind a gentle shake of his head, a sardonic smile.
Jesus, you must be shy of something to talk about in this part of the world.
He rocked back on his heels.
Where did that rumor start, Dan?
He asked. Danny shook his head unhappily.
I don't know. By the time I heard it, half the squad were talking about it.
And Emma? Our history. That isn't common knowledge.
But now Danny's eyes were impatient.
Cormac, it's the bloody Garda Síochána. Half the country probably know about that after your first date.
Cormac's phone started to ring, and he took it from his pocket, checked the screen. It was Matt calling him back. Maybe with information about Anthony Healy. Cormac muted the call.
Tell me, Dan,
he said, keeping his tone conversational.
What's the story with Healy?
What? Danny looked confused, wrong-footed by the turn in the conversation.
Don't bullshit me. I know there's something going on. Healy's worried about you. I want to know why.
Danny stared back at him. His face was completely blank.
Nothing's happened. They don't like me. I don't like them. It's a personality clash, that's all.
That's not what you said last time we spoke about this. You said you couldn't talk then for fear of the backlash. But I'm telling you, Dan, if you know something, now's the time to come out with it.
Danny grimaced, a tight twist of his mouth.
I'm on the outs because Healy has no respect for anyone outside the unit. He doesn't want locals on the team. Doesn't want us screwing up his good work. That's it.
Danny's expression oozed sincerity. He was a good liar. If Healy hadn't been so obvious, Cormac might even have believed him. Danny checked his watch.
I have to go, he said. I have to meet my parents. Fill them in on what's being done to find Lorna.
His expression was bleak.
I don't know if they'll ever forgive me for getting it so wrong.
I'm sorry, Danny. If there's anything I can do, you'll ask me.
Christ. Cormac felt completely off balance. He was having a go when Danny was trying to process the fact that the sister he'd thought was on the tear had in fact been missing for nearly 2 weeks now. Was in God only knew what sort of trouble, while he'd been running around doing everything possible to slow the work of the team looking for her. Danny shook his head.
Do one thing for me, Cormac. Just take another look at your case, will you? The look on your face in there when you heard about Hannah's statement. I'm worried that you have blinders on about this woman. Maybe she's not the innocent victim she was when you met her. Maybe she was never the innocent victim.
Cormac said nothing, and Danny shook his head in exasperation.
Do you know when she came back to Ireland?
Danny asked.
It wasn't for the funeral. Her flight landed in Ireland on the 13th of March, 3 days before her brother died.
And that hit Cormac hard. For the first time he realized how badly he wanted Maud to be innocent, how convinced of her innocence he was.
Just think about it, Cormac, okay?
Danny said. Then he turned and walked back into the station. Cormac followed a moment later, returned to his desk just long enough to grab his coat and his notebook, and got out of there. He was dialing Emma's number before he'd gone 10 meters from the station.
Em?
Hi. Yeah, hang on just 2 seconds.
Then a moment later,
so, what do you think, will we go?
It took him a moment to remember what she was talking about, another to realize that he had called her without thinking, to pour out the story to her,
to find reassurance and comfort in her support. Christ, Emma couldn't fix this, and dumping it all on her would be a shitty thing to do.
Cormac?
Yeah, sorry. I can't go away this weekend. Just rang to tell you. Things are picking up at the station. I may have to work.
Oh, but that's good, isn't it? Something's happening on the case?
Cormac was crossing over the bridge. The wind whipped her words away. He cupped the bottom of his phone with his other hand, pressed it to his ear.
Yeah, lots happening. We'll go next weekend, all right?
Even with the wind, he could pick up the relief in her voice, the lightness in her tone when she agreed and suggested alternative plans for their weekend. A late breakfast together on Saturday before he started work. If he was going to work, then maybe she would too. And then perhaps they could go out to eat afterwards. He agreed with everything, his mind already elsewhere. He said his goodbyes and was about to hang up when she spoke again.
Corm, is everything all right, really?
He hesitated.
Everything's fine, Em. Gotta run.
Cormac hung up and put his phone back in his pocket. It was the first time he had lied to her. Well, the first time about anything that mattered. Was that true? Hadn't he lied to her about the move to Galway? No, he'd been okay with that, genuinely, convinced that he'd be able to make it work.
How wrong he had been. Someone in the station wanted to take him down, and it went beyond petty professional jealousy, didn't it? That rumor about Maud Blake, that was dangerous. That was a career killer. And there was fuck all he could do about it. If he responded to it, he gave it life, legitimacy, and if he ignored it, it would fester.
Cormac stopped, realizing that he had walked halfway up Shop Street with no destination in mind. He wasn't ready to return to the station, not until he'd had a chance to think everything through. He was standing directly outside Elle's Cafe. Food might help. Coffee definitely would. He went inside, ignoring the queue at the takeout counter. He ordered coffee and a sandwich and found a seat at the back of the room. The tables were small, the chairs delicate. He settled himself gingerly into a chair not designed for a 6'3", 190-pound man. His legs barely fit under the table. The cafe was busy. Background music and the chatter of multiple conversations blocking out individual voices. Cormac took out his notebook, flicked back through the pages. He thought best with a pen in his hand, a piece of paper in front of him. He had orders to take Maud Blake in for questioning, but he wasn't ready. It was too soon. Was there a chance that Danny was right? Did he have blinkers on when it came to this case? He flicked back through his notes, following the logic of his investigation so far. No. It was bullshit. If Danny, or anyone else for that matter, thought that he was missing or ignoring evidence because he was convinced of Maud's innocence, they were wrong.
How are you?
He looked up.
Detective O'Halloran.
She took the seat opposite him without waiting for an invitation. She was wearing a black rain jacket. Her curly hair was damp and tousled by the wind. She was eating an apple. She took a small bite, chewed and swallowed.
I worked with a friend of yours last year, on a sex trafficking thing. Sean Hegarty? You know him, right?
She didn't wait for his response.
I called him up. Asked about you. He said you're good at your job.
The expression on Carrie's face said she had trouble believing it.
I'll have to thank Sean next time I see him, said Cormac.
He didn't say that Sean had said the same about her. She took another bite of her apple, chewed, waited for him to fill the silence. Cormac took a bite from his panini, chewed, and washed it down with coffee. Said nothing.
You're good friends with McIntyre, aren't you?
Carrie said eventually. Cormac raised an eyebrow.
Known him a long time, have you? Old school friends, is that the story?
We were in Templemore at the same time, Cormac said.
Stayed in touch over the years. Meet up regularly with the wives, the kids, that sort of thing?
Her eyes strayed to Cormac's left hand, where she clocked the absence of a wedding ring.
I wouldn't say that, no,
said Cormac. Her questions had the rhythm of an interrogation. He could tell her to fuck off, but he was curious to see where she was going. She was interesting, too, something about the brightness of her eyes, the bird-like cock of her head.
He's had a bit of a hard time lately, your friend.
Cormac laughed.
Fair to say you've had something to do with that.
He's told you she's at a music festival, hasn't he? In Wales.
That's what he thought. Not anymore.
Because of the mystery friend, right? The mystery friend that no one else has spoken to? That no one else has ever heard of?
Cormac had his sandwich halfway to his mouth. He put it down.
What are you saying?
Only that I tried the number Danny gave me. It was a pay-as-you-go mobile, and it hasn't been switched on in 2 weeks. Not a single ping. How many 20-year-olds do you know who can do without their phone that long?
You think Danny made her up? Why?
To stop the search for his sister.
Cormac shook his head.
That's ridiculous. Why would Danny do that? Even if he... There'd be no point to it. The best he would achieve is to delay the search, not stop it.
Precisely. She said the word casually. There was no heat in it.
Cormac sat back in his chair.
What exactly do you think happened to her?
Lorna's been living with an aunt in Dublin. She went home for a weekend visit for Paddy's Day, never came back. I know Lorna from an incident last year. When the aunt reported her as a missing person, the case came to me.
And you've run with it?
A flash of anger crossed her face and was gone. She placed her apple core neatly on the table, balanced on one end.
Maybe you should ask him about it yourself, she said.
Ask him what? Danny went to Dublin, he found the friend, who wasn't calling him back either, by the way. He found her and she finally told him the truth. Now Danny's doing everything he can to make things right.
She smiled, a quick, happy smile, incongruous to the situation.
He does seem to be, doesn't he? Still, he could probably use a friend. Might be best to stay close to him. Might take your mind off your own problems.
She stood, slapped the table briskly.
Enjoy your lunch, Detective, and best of luck with your case.
O'Halloran.
She'd taken a few steps away but stopped when she heard her name, turned inquiring eyes towards him. She wasn't what he had been expecting. He wanted to ask her why she'd come to him, what she expected him to do. She obviously had a theory, and he wanted to push her to share it. He wanted to ask, too, about the tension he'd felt at the station, if she knew what was going on with Anthony Healy. But all of that would take trust, and he barely knew her. He shook his head, returned his attention to his meal.
I didn't believe it, if that's what you're wondering, she said.
And she was gone. Friday, 29th of March, 2013. Chapter 19. He had his orders, and the clock was ticking. He wasn't ready to bring Maud in for formal questioning, but he wanted to take her temperature, get a read. First thing Friday morning, he called to the hotel, asked for her at the front desk, but there was no answer from her room. He left a message and his mobile number. She might call him. If not, he would call back at the end of the day. After that, he went to the office, caught up on messages, tried to find Danny, but he wasn't at his desk and he wasn't answering his phone. After what he'd found in Dublin, he might have taken some time off, might be with his family. Cormac thought about calling to Danny's house on his way back from Kilmore. The house was in Salt Hill, and although Cormac wasn't sure of the address, he could get it if he had to. Cormac drove out of Galway on the Moycullen Road in the direction of Kilmore. It was a 2-hour drive, but there was one person he hadn't spoken to yet who might be able to provide some answers. Domenica Keane was still alive. Still alive, and living in the same house, a bungalow no more than a kilometer from the driveway that led to the old Dower House. In Cormac's memory, the old house was totally isolated. But then memory played tricks, and perhaps over time his mind had forgotten some details, dramatized others. Based on Catherine Shelley's description, Cormac thought Keane must be in her 70s at least, and possibly older. A phone call to the local post office, despite the digital age still one of the best ways of getting information in rural areas, had confirmed that Domenica Keane was still receiving letters at her old address. The postmistress had not been particularly garrulous, and subtle and not-so-subtle questioning had yielded no more information than that. He didn't like going in raw, with so little preparation. It was after 3 before he left Galway. He called Danny's mobile twice along the way, but it went to voicemail. Carrie O'Halloran had started something. He was aware that the part of his mind that wasn't occupied with the Blake case was nagging away at him, demanding that he give more attention to the impression he had formed of O'Halloran. She hadn't hidden her dislike of Danny, but she still hadn't struck him at all as the woman Danny had described, as someone motivated by personal dislike. He needed to think about that, about what it might mean. As Cormac pulled up outside the Keane house, he saw a woman leaving, pulling the door shut behind her. She was too young to be Domenica Keane, in her mid-30s if he had to hazard a guess. She was dressed comfortably in jeans and a fleece jacket. Her dark hair was escaping from a ponytail, the wind blowing it about her face. "Hello," he said as he shut the car door behind him. "Hello yourself," she said, and waited near the door for his approach.
"I wanted to see Domenica. Is she in?"
The woman nodded. "She's in the kitchen." A pause, during which she gave him a friendly look over. "She didn't mention that she was expecting visitors."
"That's the kind of thing she would mention," Cormac asked.
The woman laughed, a warm and genuine sound.
"You'd better believe it," she said. "Are you a relative?"
Her eyes were still assessing, and Cormac thought she knew already that he wasn't. He shook his head.
"I'm not. I'm a guard. I need to ask Domenica a few questions. Nothing to worry anyone, just a bit of ancient history."
She nodded slowly, her eyes still considering.
"Are you a friend of hers?"
he asked.
"Do you think she'd be up to a few questions?"
The woman extended her hand for a shake. "I'm Caoimhe O'Neill," she said. "Public health nurse. I'm here most days."
"She's not well."
"Just dressing changes, leg ulcer. Not unusual for a woman her age."
"Right," Cormac said. "She'd be all right for a few questions."
Caoimhe blew out her breath.
"If you mean is she senile, then no, she's not. If you mean will she tell you the truth, I wouldn't count on it."
Cormac laughed himself now.
"A Garda can never count on that one."
She rolled her eyes. "My husband's a guard. I never get tired of hearing about it." The wind was a little higher now, and a light drizzle had started. Cormac would have moved forward, but she continued. "I'm not joking," she said. "You'd want to watch yourself with her."
"Sorry?"
"I'm telling you to watch yourself with her. She's dangerous." Cormac was smiling now, waiting for the punchline.
"Does she keep a pistol under her cushion?"
he asked. The woman, Caoimhe, rolled her eyes again. She took a phone from the pocket of her jacket and held up the screen so he could see it. "See this?" she asked. "It's set to record. It's always set to record while I'm in that house. I'm not the first public health nurse to be assigned to Miss Keane. The last one ended up being transferred because she made a complaint."
"Which was?"
"She went to the guards claiming that the girl assaulted her. Keane had a black eye and a split lip. The girl? She was only a young one. A midwife, really, not a public health nurse, and just out of training college. It's hard to get fully trained public health nurses out here, but she was a nice girl. Loved her job, very enthusiastic." Cormac glanced towards the house. It was early evening, but so overcast that the light had been sucked out of the day. The windows were dark, hostile. The house looked empty, but he knew it wasn't, and he was conscious that the conversation they were having would be better had elsewhere. He didn't have time. He wasn't going to drag this thing out any more than he absolutely had to. He wanted it done.
"You don't think she did it?"
"Not a chance."
"Was the girl charged?"
"Yes, but in the end Domenica dropped the charges, after the girl was suspended, and she went home to her parents."
"Why would she make it up if the girl did nothing wrong? And where did she get the black eye?"
Caoimhe shook her head, glanced back over her shoulder at the house. "Honestly, I think she did it to herself. It would have been worth it to her. She would have seen it as taking the girl down a peg or two. Domenica doesn't like happy people. I think what she wanted was to damage that girl's confidence, to poison her enthusiasm for helping people." Caoimhe walked to her car and opened the passenger door to put her bag inside.
"If you're right, she sounds like a lovely person," Cormac said.
She turned to him. "I think she's a sociopath," she said matter-of-factly. "So remember that, and watch yourself." She held her phone up again and wiggled it at him. He nodded.
Thanks for your help, he said.
She was walking around her car to the driver's door.
Not a bother, she smiled at him. Good luck with whatever you're after.
A last smile and a wave, and as she reversed down the drive, he felt absurdly bereft. As he approached the front door, he wasn't thinking about the interview ahead, but that Caoimhe O'Neill's husband, whoever he was doing all right for himself. He rang the doorbell and waited. Rang a second time. He could hear a movement from within the house, but it was a full 10 minutes before the door opened slowly to a gap of about 10 centimeters, as wide as permitted by a security chain firmly in place. The woman standing inside the door peered through the gap, but said nothing. She was a little stooped with age, but tall, nevertheless. Very tall for a woman, not quite his 6'3", but she wouldn't have been far off it. Cormac held up his ID to her.
Mrs. Keane, I'm Detective Sergeant Cormac Riley. I'd like to speak with you about something, if you can spare a few minutes.
You'll have to wait while I get my glasses. I can't read anything without them.
She closed the door. The minutes ticked by, and he began to feel the cold. Cormac checked his watch. He wanted to get back to Galway in time to have a late dinner with Emma. He would interview Maud the next day, but not before speaking with a police doctor about the post-mortem report. He wanted to get a clearer picture of what condition Hilaria had been in, given the advanced stage of her disease. And maybe the Keane interview, if she ever came back and opened the bloody door, would give him something to work with, an angle to take with the questioning. He had to keep a momentum going or this case would slip out of his hands. Murphy wanted an arrest. If Maud had murdered her mother, Murphy would have to get it. But there would be no arrest without evidence to support a prosecution, at least not while it was his case and his decision to make. If he hoped to find evidence to prove Maud's innocence, that wouldn't stop him asking the right questions. He stamped his feet to warm them and tucked his hands into his armpits. She'd probably lost her glasses, or maybe even forgotten he was there. He knocked again, twice. But it was another 5 minutes before she opened the door again, glasses on this time, and held out her hand for his ID. He held it up for her, and she took his wrist and pulled it towards her through the crack in the door with more strength than he would have expected.
Special Detective Unit,
she read slowly. He still had his old badge, hadn't made the effort to get it changed. He'd kept his gun, too, had never returned it when he left the SDU. More detectives were carrying now, even outside the units, and he'd assumed he'd be one of them. Either the powers that be felt the same way, or they'd simply forgotten to ask. Keane hadn't released his wrist, and he didn't like to pull away, for fear he would unbalance her. Her lips were red and unpleasantly wet, and his eyes were drawn to them as she spoke.
And what are the likes of you doing down here?
I'd like to speak with you about something that happened a number of years ago. The death of Hilaria Blake. You remember her?
Domenica Keane's eyes were still sharp under drooping upper lids. They brightened on hearing Hilaria's name.
Of course I remember her. Poor, poor dear.
Cormac pulled his wrist slowly but firmly away from her. She resisted the pressure for a moment, then released him. She pushed the door closed, slid the security chain aside, and opened it.
Come in, detective, she said.
He entered a hall carpeted in pale peach, the carpet thinning in the center. The walls were papered in a flowered pattern up to a low timber data rail, and painted a paler peach above the rail. The decor was so like that of his grandparents' old home in West Cork that it was disconcerting. But this house, for all its superficial similarities, had none of the warmth of his grandparents' place. It smelled stale and unused. Domenica Keane gestured towards a door at the end of the hall, and he turned and walked towards it, only to stop and wait for her, as he realized that her progress was slow. She walked with a shuffling gait, hands clasped in front of her and eyes downcast, as if she was in a state of permanent worry. He waited for her to draw almost level with him. Then he opened the door and stepped inside the room, holding the door open for her. The kitchen was unpleasantly hot and stuffy. There was an old-fashioned 3-bar gas heater at the other end of the room. He hadn't seen one like it in years, but the thing obviously still worked,
It was blasting out enough heat for a room three times the size.
Domenica Keane settled herself into an armchair that had been placed at the side of the kitchen table, facing the door. She gestured for him to take a seat, and he pulled out a kitchen chair and turned it so that he could face her.
"It's Miss,"
she said, as he took his notebook from his pocket.
"I'm sorry,"
he said.
"You said Mrs. Keane at the door, but I've never married. I think accuracy is important, don't you? Certainly to a detective, I would have thought."
"That's right, Miss Keane. My apologies."
"I expect you think that all ladies of my generation married at some point or the other. Unless, of course, they were utterly unmarriageable, which I was not. But that wouldn't be accurate, Detective. There were plenty of women my generation who made their own way in the world. Some of them foolishly and wantonly, it should be said. But some of us had a higher calling, and marriage would have been a distraction."
She spoke very slowly and deliberately, but her voice was clear and strong and held no quaver. As she spoke, she let her eyes drift to a framed photograph hung on the wall. It was a close-up of a woman in her 30s, with strong features and a muscular jawline, dressed in what looked like a wimple.
"You were a member of a religious order."
She inclined her head. She must have been very strong when she was younger. The hands she clasped lightly together in her lap were unusually large for a woman, and although she must have lost body weight and muscle tone as she'd aged, he could see hints of her former self in the shape of her shoulders.
"Miss Keane, I'd like to ask you some questions about Hilaria Blake. You've said that you remember her."
She tilted her head to one side.
"I do remember her. Poor dear woman. Such a terrible waste."
"You mean her alcoholism?"
"Do I?"
Domenica Keane was smiling gently at him. Cormac suppressed a flare of irritation and smiled back at her.
"You were aware that Hilaria Blake was an alcoholic?"
"Oh, I wouldn't say that, Detective. I'd say she liked a little drink, but who could blame her? She was lonely, I'm sure. Our husband left her to raise two children alone. Terribly difficult thing to do in that day and age."
"Hilaria Blake was not married, Miss Keane, and her children had two different fathers."
"Oh dear. It seems she misled me."
But Domenica Keane kept smiling. Her mouth was wet, her lips slightly parted.
"I understand that you were quite close to Hilaria, that you visited her, that you provided support to the family."
"My Christian duty."
"Did you object when Children and Family Services wanted to take Maud and Jack into care?"
"A disgrace."
"I'm sorry?"
"Taking children from their natural mother. That is an action against God. If God had intended Hilaria to be childless, he wouldn't have sent her those two beautiful children."
She stretched the word out. Beautiful. From her mouth it sounded obscene.
"But you do understand that the children were abused."
"Abuse, what nonsense. They may have had to wait for a meal or two from time to time. I can tell you when I grew up that was just a normal day. Hilaria loved her children. She cared for them well. If they didn't have hundreds of toys, well, that is hardly abuse."
"It was quite a bit worse than that, Miss Keane. Jack Blake was beaten. His sister, too. They were badly neglected. Jack was malnourished. I would think that is the result of something more serious than a few late meals."
She gave him another slow, deliberate smile.
"Well, you're certainly entitled to your opinion, Detective."
"You spent time with the family?"
"Yes. Hilaria and I used to pray together."
"You were at the house regularly then?"
And at her nod, "You never saw signs of abuse?"
I remember that the little boy was forever falling down. Clumsy little thing, but no, no abuse at all.
How often did you visit the family?
She tilted her head to one side. On her, it was the most artificial gesture, as if she'd seen other people do it and had chosen to imitate.
Almost every day, except Monday, when I did the church flowers.
Cormac turned back some pages in his notebook. Jack Blake was examined at the hospital after his mother's death. He was found to have numerous healed fractures. 3 ribs had been fractured at least once. He'd suffered a broken tibia and fibia. 2 fingers on his left hand had also been broken. He had burns to his left shoulder.
Cormac looked up at her.
In all your daily visits to the house, you never saw any evidence of these injuries?
She tutted.
Clumsy. Little. Boy.
She enunciated each word clearly, but it was her smile that made his anger roar. He was careful to show nothing. He wouldn't give the bitch the satisfaction.
You were aware, of course, that Hilaria Blake died of a heroin overdose.
Did she indeed? Well, isn't that shocking?
Yes, although she was dying in any case. You must have known that she had very advanced liver failure.
Are you quite sure you are supposed to be sharing all this information with me, Detective? I must say it seems very indiscreet.
She made a show of looking at her watch, then distractedly around the room.
Did you have a question for me at all?
Nearly finished, Miss Keane. Just another question or two and I'll leave you in peace.
Cormac paused. He was working on instinct now. The truism that a lawyer should never ask a question to which he did not already know the answer did not apply to detectives. If anything, the opposite rule applied. You had a plan going into every interrogation, but sometimes it was best to follow your instinct, and his instinct was screaming at him that Domenica Keane knew something.
There is one question I'd very much like your help on. I understand that there may have been other visitors to the house. Members of your prayer group, perhaps?
Domenica Keane snickered, as if he had told her an off-color joke.
Of course. Hilaria was someone who had strayed from God's side. She knew that, and our little group was always willing to do whatever hard work was required to bring someone back to God's loving arms.
Who exactly?
I'm sorry?
Other than yourself, which members of your prayer group visited the Blake home?
Well, let me think, the old woman said, again tilting her head to the side. Do you know, I think I'm having some trouble recalling the details. It was all such a very long time ago.
Cormac made a show of looking back to an earlier page of his notebook, of taking a further note.
I must say I'm surprised, Miss Keane.
She didn't respond. Your memory has been very clear so far. But perhaps you just need some time to think, to remember. He looked at her with cool dispassion. She was old, and she was evil. But he had experience on his side. He had sat in 100 interviews with 100 criminals, and he had approached interrogations with almost every conceivable tactic. People like Domenica Keane were too clever. They lied when they should stay quiet. They thought ahead, saw the risks, and moved to tie them off. They could never quite see how the slow setting down of questions and noting of answers could drive them into a trap of their own making. She was waiting, watching, her eyes still amused, but a little careful.
There wasn't someone in particular, someone other than yourself who developed a friendship with Hilaria Blake.
Well, now, let me think.
She made a show of putting a finger to her lips. Tap, tap, tap.
I suppose there was Simon... What was his name again? Smith? No. A German name, most unusual. Schmidt. Something like that, perhaps.
There was amusement in her eyes.
Schmidt,
Cormac said, his tone flat. He tried the notebook trick again, turning back a page and making a show of checking something.
I think that was it. But I'm such a very old lady detective. I really can't be sure of anything.
Tell me about him.
Oh, I don't recall much, I'm afraid. Simon was part of our group for only a short time. He was a teacher, if I remember correctly. Taught at the primary school, I believe.
Cormac's confidence that he had found something dropped. Hard to see a primary school teacher as a drug dealer. But there was definitely something here. She was watchful now.
Did he move on?
I'm sorry?
You said he wasn't with your group very long. Why did he leave?
Domenica shook her head.
Who can say what tempts people from the arms of the Lord, Detective? It's not something I've ever understood.
Right. You introduced Simon to the family.
I really don't recall.
But you knew him.
We had similar interests, certainly, while he was a member of our little group. I believe he was very involved in charitable causes. Such a good man, so very caring, particularly good with children.
Cormac thought back to the night he had taken the children from the house. He thought of the cold, the squalor, their pinched little faces. There had been no evidence of care there. How long had Simon been helping the family?
I really can't recall, Detective.
What help exactly did he provide?
It's such a long time ago, and really I can't be sure I ever knew. Simon was very much his own man.
I see. Can you recall which charities, exactly, Mr. Schmidt was involved with?
Was something to do with children? Possibly a food drive?
She yawned, making no attempt to cover her mouth.
Oh, dear. I'm really feeling quite tired. It seems you have worn me out, Detective.
He got no further after that. Her answers got vaguer and started to wander into old memories that had little relevance to the Blakes. He felt sure that her sudden senility was an act, but equally didn't know what else, if anything, he could hope to get from her. He also had a sudden and raging headache. She was lying about Simon Schmidt. That much was obvious. About his name, at least, if not about more. Why? What was she hiding? He would need to find the man. Someone in the village might remember him, or at the school. A primary school teacher with a German-sounding surname should be remembered. Cormac stopped asking questions and let the silence sit while he took a moment to finish his notes. When he glanced up, Domenica Keane's eyes were half closed, as if she were drifting off to sleep. He closed his notebook and stood, speaking loudly.
I'd say goodbye, so, Miss Keane.
She gave what he was sure was a faked start of surprise, putting a large hand to her chest.
Oh, Detective, I was nearly asleep. I always have a nice little nap at this time of day. I'm sure you can see yourself out.
She smiled her unpleasant smile, dragging her thin lips over teeth that were too big for her mouth. Cormac wondered what she had looked like when Maud and Jack knew her. He thought she would have been a frightening sight for a child. The interview with Keane left a bad taste in Cormac's mouth, and there wasn't much he could do about it. He breathed in fresh air outside the house and felt his headache ease. He had a 2-hour drive back to Galway ahead of him. It would be after 8 before he got back. He felt more confident after the Keane interview. There was a story here. There were secrets that hadn't been told, but he would get to the bottom of them. He had a hold on this case now, and he wasn't going to let it go. Keane knew something. Collins knew something. He'd worked with Les in the past. The next step was to track down the German. What had really been going on between Hilaria, Keane, and that mystery man? It sure as hell hadn't been prayer. He felt more confident in Maud's innocence. There was a bigger story here, and he meant to get to the bottom of it. Hannah Collins was not a reliable witness, and he'd been there that night himself, was the closest thing to a real witness there was, perhaps. There'd been no anger in Maud, no fear. She had just been sad, sad to the bone. Her disappearance added something to the picture, that was true, but Cormac was inclined to put that down to trauma, or, it occurred to him as he drove, her instinct to protect Jack. She'd wanted him adopted, hadn't she? She had known that the chances were much smaller if she was in the picture. He thought of that sad smile he'd seen in the rearview mirror all those years before, and a piece of the puzzle clicked into place. Why hadn't he seen it then? Maybe he had. Maybe it had occurred to him and he'd filed the idea away, and it had gotten buried under a thousand other ideas, other memories, over the years. Cormac was driving into Ooptarard when his phone rang. He flipped the phone to speaker, hit accept, and balanced the phone in his lap as he drove. Fisher's voice came from the speakers, a little tinny but clear enough to be heard. His voice had the tone of a teenager handing in an assignment that had kept him from playing football all weekend, relieved that it was done, but knowing that it would never get him to the FA Cup. He'd found Timothy Lanigan.
"He's not teaching anymore," Fisher said. "He owns a bar at Strand Hill in Sligo. He came back to Ireland after his divorce, must have given up teaching. He's been in Strand Hill for the past 15 years, and before that worked at a bar in Dublin. No criminal record, not even a speeding ticket."
Cormac had news for Fisher as well. He had spoken to Matt the night before.
"You said before he divorced, when? 1985? So he's been back in Ireland for 28 years. I want to know every address he lived at, every job he worked since he came back to this country."
Fisher's silence spoke for him.
"There was another murder," Cormac said, "in 1983. A 15-year-old student at the school, St. Whatever's Catholic Academy. Lanigan was her soccer coach. She disappeared after practice one day. Her body was found 2 days later. She'd been raped and strangled. Lanigan was interviewed, but his wife alibied him, and he was never a serious suspect. Girl's boyfriend was charged. She'd been planning to dump him. Boy spent a few months in jail before blood tests came back and exonerated him."
"Jesus, they got DNA.
Fisher's tone had changed completely.
"They have the samples," Cormac said. "They didn't test for DNA in those days, but if we can get a sample, they'll test it now."
"Will I start the warrant application? I can do it now. Have it ready for you in the morning?"
"No warrant," Cormac said. "You issue Lanigan with a warrant and he'll disappear. Irish passport, he'll jump on a cheap flight to France and have the whole of Europe to hide in."
A moment's silence on the phone.
"Covert DNA?"
Fisher asked.
"That's the plan," said Cormac. "Find out what you can about his movements, but do it without scaring him off. Get us something to work with, and we'll go up there this weekend."
Cormac made a silent apology to Emma, but knew she'd understand. Fisher agreed and thanked him. He was smart enough to know that Cormac didn't need to bring him along for the ride, that a case like this, if they could break it, could make his career. He was probably also conscious that his lack of enthusiasm for the earlier work hadn't been difficult to read. Fisher was all right. He was ambitious, but that was okay if it showed itself in the right way. Hard, bloody work and good instincts for making a case.
"Oh, and Fisher, run a search for me, will you? Simon Schmidt. Had an address somewhere near Kilmore in the 1990s. Text me if you find anything."
"Will do."
Cormac was about to hang up when Fisher spoke again. His voice was indistinct, and with the noise of the car and the shitty phone speakers, Cormac almost missed it. Until Fisher said it again.
"They've brought her in for questioning, Maud Blake. Thought you should know."
Then he hung up, leaving Cormac with an hour's drive ahead and a burning anger that he could do nothing to express. He changed the radio to a station playing hard rock and turned the music up. Chapter 20. Aisling sat on a bench in the hospital locker room, pulling on her boots. Her shift was over, and she was due to meet Maud in an hour, a prospect she was dreading. She hadn't seen her since Monday, hadn't called her to pass on Aggie's invitation, hadn't even called the police to ask about Jack's phone. She had managed to get a copy of the post-mortem report through a friend who had made it clear he thought reading it would be A, weird, and B, a very bad idea. And she had called a friend who worked in a London hospital and asked her to send her some mifepristone and misoprostol through the post. It was a huge ask. Though abortion was legal in the UK, posting pills to a patient you hadn't seen was not. But Claire hadn't hesitated. The drugs weren't monitored as carefully as drugs commonly abused, like opiates or tranquilizers, and she'd managed to lift some extras without being noticed. They'd arrived that morning, those innocent-looking white tablets, and now they were burning a hole in the bottom of her bag. Aisling didn't know yet what she was going to do, but she was going to make a decision this weekend one way or the other. She wasn't going to sleepwalk into 9 weeks, then onwards, until the fetus really was a baby and it was too late. There was a perfunctory knock on the door. Someone pushed it ajar, and she heard a male voice speaking.
Ash, are you decent?
What? Yeah. Is that David? He put his head around the door.
MCRS results are up.
MCRS. Membership of the Royal College of Surgeons. He was referring to the written part of the exam, a brutal 4-hour paper that had a 30% pass rate. Aisling froze, then grabbed her bag and searched through it for her phone. They're not due for another week. Had she lost track of the date?
I passed, David said. Goosens failed.
What? Aisling stopped mid-search. David was talking about Mark Goosens, private schoolboy, son of an eminent surgeon, and up until now, at least, the guy who sat in front of her on the Order of Merit. David was grinning from ear to ear. Congratulations, she said. His grin widened. She found her phone, realized that David was waiting, still watching her, and decided to hell with it. She opened her browser and went to the College of Surgeons site, then to exam results. How do you know Goosens failed? She asked.
Saw his candidate number last year, said David.
He walked over and sat beside her. She waited for the drop-down to appear, clicked quickly on exam results, and waited again. Clicked on MCRS. As the page loaded, she saw a blur of passes and fails. 20 interns sat the exam the previous November. 20 interns who were used to being the best, used to coming top in every exam. Until now. She looked for her number. Should be halfway down the page, 1623. There. Pass. Holy shit. She'd passed. She looked up at David, her own grin spreading across her